Les colloques du Collège de France.
So this is about, as I say in the first item, this is about the nature of the act that the creator of a fiction performs by making it public or however that thing is releasing the film, whatever it is. Yeah? It connects with the topic of the workshop because, as you will see, I'll be discussing mostly social views of views on which this is a sort of a speech act with a social character, and I'll be discussing what kind of a speech act it is mostly. So first I have 10 items which I want to just the handout is meant to be very detailed for you to explore it if you are interested, but I'm not going to follow it, to follow everything that is in there. So I just need to summarize what is in the first 9-10 items. So here I discuss and question what was the most common view about this in analytic philosophy since Frege, it's already in Frege. And then, if you look at famous writings about these issues in the 70s by Van Inwagen, by Kripke, by David Lewis. I'm not so clear about David Lewis now, but he was too clever. Too good a philosopher, too. Anyway, so they just take it for granted, this view. Austin, too. Yes, it's two lines. And it's articulated famously, influentially, by Searle in an article in 1975. But earlier, in a much better way, by Margaret MacDonald in another article in 1955. Kevin is very much interested in this private eye work of tracing and unacknowledged influences. I really cannot make sense that the idea that Searle didn't know this article. If you read it, the phrase "the logic of fiction" is in the first page in Margaret MacDonald, but he never acknowledged anyway. So this is what I call the mere pretense view of fiction making or fictionalizing. I will be calling this representational act if this is what it is, mere pretense. Fictionalizing, sorry. The mere pretense view is the view that put it in focusing on the linguistic case, although we want a theory that works also for films, but focusing on the linguistic case as Searle does. So there are serious speech acts that you make with utterances, assertions, commands, promises, whatever. And then there is the pretense of that. The same way that you can pretend to do other things, other acts, you can pretend to do speech acts. This is what actors do on a stage. They help the author of the play create a fiction by pretending. So nobody would deny that fictions are made by pretense, because we want to account for a theater, for instance, and in the theater clearly. And as David Lewis does, we can easily extend this idea to literary fiction, at least those that have explicit narrators. Lewis says that we can think of Conan Doyle as pretending to be Watson, making assertions. So in the fiction, Watson makes assertions, reports about the deeds of Sherlock Holmes, and Conan Doyle creates the fiction by pretending, by playing an actor, playing Watson. So nobody would deny that fictions can be created by pretense. This is why I call this view the mere pretense view, because the idea is that there is nothing more to say of a constitutive nature about what fictionalizing is. And this is clearly what Searle says, and this is clearly what MacDonald, this is even clearer in MacDonald's because they consider the what I take to be the alternative. I'm going to think that there is just one alternative. It has many, can be articulated in many different ways, but the alternative is to say, well, no, fictionalizing is not something derivative in that way from serious representational acts, in the sense that you create the fiction by simulating them or pretending to do them. No, fictionalizing is a representational act of its own, with its own distinctive character. Maybe it's derivative from assertoric speech acts, because in some sense assertoric speech acts are more basic than the others, but this is a different issue. By its very nature, it's not derivative in the way that the pretense theory. And so we have to say, in whatever ways we characterize the different character of representational acts, we have to say, well, and fiction is like those things, but with this particular character. So for instance, if you say that assertion is somehow an invitation to believe, whatever way, you would say, following Walton, that fictionalizing is an invitation to imagine. An order is an invitation to do, let us say. A promise is an invitation to think that you have an obligation. Fictionalizing is an invitation to imagine. That would be the alternative view. Searle is very unclear about articulating this. He speaks of an act of storytelling. This is, by the way, what Lewis says that the fiction maker does. So this is why I am unclear about what he thought. He didn't think very much about this, but at least he was a little bit more sensitive to this possibility. Then he says things that make me think that he was really assuming the pretense theory. For instance, the pretense theory entails that all fictions must have narrators, explicit or implicit. Because if fiction is the pretense of other speech acts, so there is someone doing in the fiction the alternative speech acts. And Lewis assumes that clearly, so that was mine. Anyway, so look at 7. There you will find how MacDonald articulates the alternative view, in my view, in a much closer to the truth way than Searle. She in fact says that this is what Moore thinks, and there is a famous discussion in the 1930s in which Moore comes close to say something like what she attributes to him. So fictionalizing would be an invitation to consider propositions. This is, as you will see, this is very close to what I think fictionalizing is, if we put it in this general way, without going into the details of whether you then go Austinian, conventional norm or way or Gricean, whatever. Both Searle and this is what I take the mere pretense view. It's a mere pretense view because it's not just that you say fictionalizing is pretense. You also say, and that's all that there is to say. In particular, fictionalizing is not a representational act with a nature analogous to that of the pretend acts. So this view allows for saying that they are fictionalizing acts that don't rely on pretense in any way, that are direct invitations to imagine, while the alternative view doesn't allow for this. This is a telling way of making the distinction, because then we can think whether we can think of cases in which we have a case of fictionalizing, and there is no reason to think that there is also the pretense of an assertion. And I take this to be one of the arguments against this view. The dividing line, in my view, for the transition from this traditional view in Nietic philosophy to the alternative, in my view, much better way of fictionalizing is Walton's work, as, by the way, Lewis acknowledges in a postscript to the Truth in Fiction paper. Walton wouldn't like to be classified with many of these. In particular, he wouldn't like to be classified in the Searle's way of presenting the alternative view because, well, first, because he has a very idiosyncratic view. He doesn't think that it makes sense to analyze the pre-theoretical concept of fiction because that is a mess, and he rejects speech acts. He thinks that you cannot make speech acts with images, which is something that, of course, I, like most people, would deny. Maps are a kind of assertions. But I take it that it was Walton, and then there are other people who put it more explicitly in the shape of a speech act of a Gracian short, like, for instance, Greg Carey. But as I say, these are just details. The distinctive way of distinguishing the two views is this fact that the mere pretense view denies that there is nothing, that there is anything more to say than fictionalizing is made by pretense. In particular, you don't go on to say fictionalizing is a kind of representational act with its own nature analogous to those of assertions. Both Searle and MacDonald have an argument against this, that the argument by Searle is terrible. You can see it there, mostly because he gets carried away and says things that are, well, silly. While MacDonald has what I take to be, after discussing this a lot with Stefano Predelli, what Searle had in mind. What Searle had in mind and what MacDonald articulates very nicely is the idea that if you are able to understand ordinary speech acts, then you can understand a fiction. You don't need anything more. Obviously, in the alternative view, you need to understand something else. At least, you need to understand a new expression that articulates fictionalizing, that this is what you are doing. So this is what I take to be the main argument for this view. What Searle says is that you need to learn the language from scratch if you buy the fictionalizing view, which is simply stupid. But it's true that you need to understand something new that tells you that either semantically or pragmatically, it doesn't matter, that tells you that a different sort of representational act is being performed. Anyway, this is it's not so easy then to have arguments for or against this view. This is why I take MacDonald's to put the idea forcefully. I think there are good reasons to deny that you don't need to understand anything else to understand that a text is produced in the fiction mode. I say here some things to this effect. I mean, to understand Bulgakov's The Devil and Margarita, I don't know how that is. To understand that, you need to know that is supposed to be fiction and not assertion. If you are not equipped with this idea, I doubt that you could be able to understand that thing or Alice, I mean, or Kafka. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss that simply. I mean, I'm going to give you what I take to be the main argument against this mere pretense view. The main argument, typically the debate is conducted by, as always in analytic philosophy, by counterexamples. So Greg Curry and Walton, too, they have this, okay, so this case of someone pretending to assert to clear up their voices. They say, well, you see, this is not fiction, but it's pretense of asserting. I don't think that these arguments are very persuasive by themselves, but I take that this leads to what I take to be the main problem of the fictionalizing view, sorry, of the pretense, mere pretense view, which is that they lack explanatory power. So they are, it lacks explanatory power. It's too inchoate a view. I mean, it's too meager what they tell you about how fiction is constituted. It's too little for getting explanatory resources for many things that we want explanations about. I think that this is what Gregg and Walton are pointing out against this mere pretense view. So I mentioned in 9 or in 9 and 10, I mentioned many examples of things that we would like a good theory of fiction to allow us to understand better. For instance, reliable and unreliable narrators. Unreliable narrators, what part of what they say is unreliable and what part is reliable. Authorial intrusions, I mean, assertions in fiction, which ones constitute the fictional world. All happy families are the same, but unhappy families differ in their own ways. Is this part of the content also of the novel, or is just an aside by the author? There are cases in which assertions in fiction are just asides from the author, but how to make the distinction? So the other theories have resources. I mean, if you are Gricean intentionalist of the extreme variety, which is very clear cut, what you are then, like Catherine Stock, you can answer these things. Well, look at the intentions of the author. That determines whether that part is reliable or unreliable. But if you are just a mere pretense theory, you don't have anything to say, as far as I can tell. By the way, now I think I always accuse François and Stefano of being contemporary, the few people that still hold this view. But now I have serious doubts about this. They insist on the mere pretense aspects of fiction, but then they tell you that they are like Walton, and they think that that fiction somehow invite imaginings. And I take it that Searle and MacDonald deny this. It's not constitutive of fictions that they do this. At least MacDonald is clear that she denies that, and she is clear about what she is defending. Anyway, so for these reasons, I don't think that we should. I mean, I'm very skeptical about philosophy, and I'm not prepared to defend my view in particular from others in the positive aspects. I mean, I just think that I like the way I would classify things, but they can be classified in many other ways. But obviously, there are mistakes in philosophy. There are philosophical views that are mistaken, and I take it that this is one. Clearly, this is a clear-cut case of a view that is simply wrong. Okay, so now if you go for the alternative view, fictionalizing is a representational act of its own, with its own distinctive character. So in particular, you can create a fiction without pretending to assert or anything else. You can make it clear that this is what you are doing. Bulgakov, in my view, does that. Berman, in persona, from the very beginning, does that. It would be, I think, absurd to think that he's making the film by pretending to assert. assert what? Is he mad? and then the issue is what. Give me more details about what sort of act that is. And so when I started writing about these things, I adopted a view. I mean, I dislike Gricean views in general of representational acts. I prefer Austinian normative accounts, which I have put aside because I only knew Searle's version, and obviously speech acts cannot be constituted by norms if you adopt Searle's view of constitutive rules. But then I read Williamson and I saw that you could go for that view in a compelling way. And so, but what I did in the first thing I wrote about this was to just translate Greg Curry's Gricean account into an Austinian framework, an Austinian constitutive rules framework. So I describe fictionalizing as a kind of conative, directive act, an invitation to imagine. But then there are other views, and I myself, as you will see, in this particular case, it's not that it could be that you could describe things the other way. It's that I'm not sure that this is the best way of describing what is going on. So this is what I want to do in the remaining time, to go through the views that are on the table. There is one that is beginning to, is coming close to be the most popular one these days, and I don't think that is compelling, and I will tell you why, and then I'll give you my doubts about my own previous self and a possible alternative. So I'm in 11 now. So in her book called Fiction, I think, Catherine, I never know whether it's Abel or Abel. I don't remember. I mean, I know her, but I don't remember how she calls herself. She defends that fictionalizings are declarations in Searle's, so a good thing in Searle. I mean, I take it that his classification of speech acts is more or less decent. So he has this category of declarations, which are speech acts that you made as part of clearly extra-linguistic institutions. So showing a red card to a player in a soccer game by the referee, that is a speech act, of, that is a declaration in which you get out of the field of the play, the player in question. Or marrying or baptizing, this sort of thing, or giving a sentence in a trial. These would be declarations. And so Catherine defends this, and my colleague Carl Berman and Nils Franzen have a very nice recent article in which they defend this view. So the latter, I mean, Berman and Franzen, they say, I mean, in 11, that the defining feature of the class of declarative illocutionary act is that they enact a change in social reality and bring about a new state of affairs by the very act of performing them. Now, this is insufficient to characterize declarations, because if you have an Austinian view of ordinary speech acts, all speech acts that are not declarations, promises, orders, assertions, they enact a change in social reality. By making an assertion, I become beholden to the truth rule or the knowledge rule or my own transmission of knowledge rule. And this is a change in social reality, so this is not good, so you have to say something else. And then they go along with Abel in characterizing declarations as illocutionary acts that are governed by the rules of extra-linguistic institutions. And then depend on this, the existence of these institutions. So this would be the way of thinking of. You think of fiction as some extralinguistic institution like soccer or a system of justice. I don't think that this is compelling. A lot here depends on how you think of the imagination. So in this alternative view, fictionalizing is an invitation to imagine. So to classify acts of inviting that, however you give the details of how that is done, so you need, it's not very clear how to judge an institution, linguistic or not linguistic, but you need to know a little bit more about the imagination. Perhaps not. I mean, perhaps it's enough with having a rough view of the imagination to see that the institution of the practice of inviting imaginings doesn't look very extralinguistic. In my own view, it cannot be, because I think of the imagination as, I have a very deflationary view of the propositional imagination, which is what is at stake in fiction, which is that, again, this is in this case is a very traditional view, and it's the one that Margaret MacDonald is assuming. This is the view that imaginings are just considering, entertainments. It's just having a proposition in mind without committing yourself to its truth or to its being worth bringing about or anything like that. This is a view that all these people that for 20 years have been working on the imagination and trying to say something interesting about it without any success hate, because they think that it deflates too much the imagination. But in my view, they haven't been able to come up with anything to make it more interesting than this. Anyway, if you think of the imagination in this way, it's very difficult to think that the practice of inviting this act is extralinguistic. Cannot be extralinguistic. It goes to the heart of what language is and what language is for. Considering propositions, very basic representational activity, I would say. So this is maybe it's not very compelling, but this is my main reason. Even if you don't buy this imagining is entertaining view, I think that you would still think that the imagination is a very central attitude which you would like to express linguistically for counting the practice of expressing it as extralinguistic, like soccer. Just think, you need to think that we need the imagination, for instance, for planning, to consider options before making a decision. That doesn't look like giving out players in soccer. Anyway, that is my reason against this declaration view. So I'll move to the last part of the talk. I am in 14 now. There is something compelling once you think of fictionalizing as something like expressing an attitude in this general way, inviting an attitude. So it's very natural to think of this inviting as inviting by itself is a directive attitude. But as Russell already said, and Henry Schiller has nicely articulated in a recent paper that I mentioned here, in some sense, inviting is involved in all speech acts. So if you are a Stolnakerian, if you think that there is something to be said for this view, that there is this common ground, and speech acts, in particular, for instance, assertion, contribute to the common ground, in that if you make an assertion and nobody objects to it, then it goes to be part of the common ground. Then assertions also involve inviting doing something, inviting putting a proposition in the common ground. So this idea that intuitively fictionalizing involves inviting imaginings is not enough for counting it as a directive, because if it were, then all acts would be directives, including assertions. So that positive consideration in favor of that directive view is not very compelling. What is the alternative? So there is a nicely articulated alternative in which, I was led to reconsider this by discussing these issues with Emmanuel Bivan, who is defending this alternative view. As far as I know, it's still not in a published paper, but the alternative is to say that this fictionalizings are assertive acts. So they are somehow truth committed. But of course, you should distinguish the commitment to truth in what Williamson calls a flat out or outright assertion from the commitment to truth in cases like fictionalizing. I was saying there is a view in the literature articulated more than 20 years ago by Predelli when he was not defending this sort of pretense theories, by Francois. I don't know whether under the influence of Predelli or on his own, but Marga Reimer also has. So they defend that as I would put it, assertions are, sorry, fictionalizings are a sort of assertions, not about the actual world, but about the fictional world. Of course, I mean, if you try to characterize the fictional world in terms of possible worlds, there is no the fictional world, but a plurality of them. Anyway, so Predelli has this way of describing that, thinking of the recording machine cases in 15. So they are, by default, the context relative to which you interpret here or now is the context of speaking, but in this answering machine cases, location in space or in time is shifted contextually, and then the idea is that when you fictionalize, you shift also the wall of evaluation from the actual world to the fictional world. And in that sense, fictionalizing would be a form of assertions. And I'm not yet convinced, but I am every day closer to this view. I think it's nice. A related issue is whether the imagination has a direction of it. I used to say that in some cases it has. I mean, in the case of the imaginings, in the case of fiction, they have the same direction of fit of assertions and beliefs, because when you imagine, you are trying to get the fictional world right. But in general, I used to think that I have a paper on this. I used to claim that in general, the imagination doesn't have a direction of fit, or has both, if you want. But now I'm every day more convinced that it has always the imagination has the direction of fit of beliefs, outright beliefs. And this is that my reason is, I think I have put it someplace here. I'm not convinced of this either, but the idea is that imaginings work with respect to desires and emotions in a similar way to beliefs, except for the fact that in the case of beliefs, you take them to be true in the actual world, and in the case of imaginings, you don't. But the way they behave functionally in our mental architecture with respect to emotions and desires is very similar. So you want to explore possibilities to feel how it would be if that was the case, to see what desires you would have if that were the case. For this, you would need, there is, so this pretense view, by the way, has a corresponding theory in the case of the mind, which is that imagination is a view about imagination that Kevin told me that Meinong had articulated very nicely, on which the imagination is half of the mind, so that there are serious attitudes, belief, visual perception, emotions, desires, and then there is the simulation of any of those things. So there are simulated emotions, simulated desires, simulated beliefs, simulated visual perceptions, and all that is the imagination. So to buy this way of thinking about direction of fit of the imagination, you have to reject that view either. Also, I mean, like the corresponding view about the speech acts, you have to say that no, the imagination is an attitude of its own, and in particular, emotions in imagining, desires in imagining, are the real thing. They are not simulations. Anyway, so this is very sketchy, but that is the way I am now thinking about fictionalizing. And so I'll conclude.
Do I still have time?
Yes, 5 minutes.
So I conclude with the last 2 points. So there is an objection that Abel and Berman and Franzen raise, which is that while standard constative, directive, expressive, or commissive speech acts can be done insincerely, fictionalizing resembles declaration in that it's not possible to be insincere in fictionalizing. I think that this is wrong. Again, one of the things that you can be wrong in philosophy. I mean, there is a general, of course, form of being insincere. The insincerity would depend on the act that you are officially performing. It's not the same thing to be insincere when you express condolences than when you assert. But I take it that there are clear cases of being insincere in fictionalizing. So, for instance, you could allegedly fictionalize, but you want what you do to be an assertion. I can write a Romana Clef about my colleagues at my department, and I only mean for that to be understood as a disguised ridiculization of my colleagues, and or a denunciation of how corrupt they are and whatever. I don't care at all about providing interesting imaginings to anybody, or maybe it's just because I mean I fear to be sued, or because we are in a repressive state and they are friends with the police, so I fear of being tortured or whatever, and I want plausible deniability. I take this to be a form of insincerity. Another objection that they provide is that, this is in the last item, is that this sort of view cannot distinguish the act of the fiction maker, the fictionalizer, from the act of the retailer. because in both cases you are, broadly speaking, inviting imaginings. To this I reply that no matter what view you have, you need to make this distinction. The distinction between someone who is authoring a representational act and someone who is merely reproducing that act. There could be different views about how you make this distinction, but you need to make it whatever your theory, and in fact they need to do the same in their own framework. So, yeah, I don't think these objections are compelling. I have this problem with the declaration view that I don't think that these acts are extra-linguistic like declarations are, and the two arguments that they provide against thinking of them as standard speech acts, I don't find them compelling. And then there is this issue about how we think what kind of standard speech act fictionalizing is, perhaps directives, but perhaps a form of constative. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Manuel.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.